CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph.
I'm your host, Dan Evans. This is Books for Breakfast, CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph. And last week on the show, we had live guest Matthew Stadler. He was quite an impressive guy. He was in town for the Big Ideas Lecture, sponsored by Misa Geddes and Kafka. Matthew Stadler and his partner, Patricia Noh, are the partners who started a really amazing print-on-demand press in Portland, Oregon, called Publication Studio. They call it a laboratory for publication in its fullest sense, not just the production of books, but the production of a public. This public, which is more than a market, is created through deliberate acts, the circulation of texts, discussions, gatherings in physical space, and the maintenance of a digital commons. It's a pretty amazing project, and you can check it out yourself at publicationstudio.biz. It's so amazing that it has ended up inspiring five other iterations of this. Vancouver, Berkeley, Toronto, Bordeaux, and somewhere else. Maybe Chicago? Anyways, I had a great time at the lecture, which was last Wednesday, June 6th. And then, as you can tell from the mandate statement there, they also followed up, Matthew and Misa Geddes followed up the lecture with a dinner to celebrate one of the newest releases. It came through Publication Studio Bordeaux, and it's called Revolution a Reader. It's edited by Matthew Stadler and his longtime friend and co-conspirator, poet Lisa Robertson, who used to be from Toronto. I know she's all over the world now. Anyways, I wanted to show you. Last week we talked to Matthew live, and you can catch our archives at booksradio.com. So that's just the Books for Breakfast website. And of course, on CFRU.ca, there's a wonderful archive of all past shows there if you wanted to listen instead of live, if you wanted to stream. Or no, that's not streaming, is it? Silly me. Anyways, I did also want to treat you to the lecture. So instead of regular programming this week, I'm going to play the pre-recorded lecture from last week, the 6th. It's a Wednesday. It's Matthew Stadler. He's live in Guelph talking about his project, Publication Studios. This is Books for Breakfast, CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph. Thanks for tuning in.
You're listening to Campus Community Lectures on CFRU 93.3 FM. Today's lecturer is Matthew Stadler, who spoke recently in Guelph as part of the Big Ideas in Art and Culture lecture series presented by Misa Geddes and Kafka. Stadler introduces us to Publication Studio, a print-on-demand publisher that serves as a space for publication in its fullest sense, and he proposes that publishing doesn't simply produce books, but also produces new publics through the shared experience of reading. Stay tuned to Campus Community Lectures on CFRU 93.3 FM.
It's great to have a modest project like Publication Studio recognized as a big idea. I mean, that's quite a threshold to approach, but I think the hunch is right that part of what's going on right now at smaller scales are really things that are going to reach big publics. And something's going on right now where to work at a small and local scale is really a potent way to affect global issues. And the story I'm going to tell you tonight is about exactly that, how a small number of people can do something which might make a difference. I want to thank the staff who's hosted me, Alyssa, who you just heard from, Sean Van Slaus, Danica Everling, wonderful, really supportive people, incredibly curious and engaged. I've never really encountered a foundation like this. In addition to the staff, I don't really know the whole ecology of the Misa Geddes Foundation, but the support for new work and research, which I'm seeing here in Guelph, and as mentioned, is extending to other mid-sized cities, is quite rare, and particularly the level and intensity of that engagement. And my read of it is that this really flows from a culture that is based in curiosity and inquiry, and it's come in part, at least, out of the research in motion business, an initiative which is part of this region, and which part of what interests me most is the way in which business and art and social inquiry really form a single mix. These are not separate worlds. And actually, quite a bit of my talk is about this question of how it is that artistic insight, the sensibilities that we often think of as somehow, you know, apart from economic reality, in fact are an integrated part of that. And here in the program that has brought me as a speaker, we see that in action. We see a really rich mix of innovation that crosses the lines from business to arts to culture. And that's exciting to me. I'm a writer. You know, I've come out of an economy which is usually thought of as, at best, desperate. And rightly so. Writers have a lot to focus on. And often the demands of the economy and of career are distractions. But the story I'm going to tell you tonight is a story of those barriers falling apart. A story of changes that I think are quite broad and reach all of you in different parts of your lives as they have reached me as a writer, where what we used to think of as some kind of separate pragmatic sphere of tough real world decisions, in fact, is and should be a deeply integrated part of the artistic imagination and what we sort of love and value most in our lives. And so I've given it a title of Learning Publication, One Book at a Time. It's going to take me a little less than an hour to tell you this story. There's some interesting characters and some good pictures along the way. And at the end, of course, questions will be welcome, and we can go with those as long as you like. So three years ago, I was broke, which is to say middle class broke, meaning I had a house to live in. I had a lot of valuable stuff, but I didn't have any job. I had less than $800, debts well beyond that, and a kid to raise. Since I'm a writer, I'm used to this kind of thing. And I live in Portland, Oregon, where middle class broke is still a viable and common part of the economy. Portland's not a rich city. It never has been. There are so many kinds of broke, and one real tragedy of the last 10 years or so, at least in the U.S., has been the disappearance of what I'm calling middle-class broke. So now the perils of low savings or material want have often become a one-way street to dispossession, debt, permanent problems. I think it's less so in Canada, but this economic collapse and the cruelty that has come with it really is global. People do not swing back up so much as they did before. And I didn't know that really back in 2009. And it was summertime. My kid was happy. And this relative poverty and joblessness felt less like a disaster and more like some kind of freedom. Portland has always had high unemployment. It's markedly higher than nearby cities like Seattle, Vancouver, BC. Really, the three of them form a region often called Cascadia. Their economies come from the same source, a kind of resource extraction that landed there in the mid to late 19th century and drove this sudden growth. Somehow Portland, the oldest of the three cities, ended up with a pattern of a much, much less capitalized, much lower scaled economy with all consistently higher unemployment. Oregon's economy, the state Portland is in, is actually closer to Mississippi's, which is really the poster child of American poverty, than it is to a state like California. It's chronically high unemployment, low capitalization, very, very few big companies, very little investment in government or social services. So people have done things broke in Portland for a long time. At least a third of my friends were unemployed, including a smart young woman named Patricia Ngo. First daughter of immigrant Koreans, Patricia was raised as a piano prodigy in Rochester, New York. But she gave up music and became a writer after studying with poet Ann Lauterbach at Bard College. And then in 2007, she moved to Portland. She got a job with an architect, a man named Brad Klopfel, and then lost the job when things contracted and Brad's firm had to downsize. But Patricia stayed in Portland looking for work. She wanted to stay, despite the fact that the city is not a place to find a job. She and I have crossed paths a lot. We'd talk about writing. We talk about little projects, ways to make some money, this, the whole microeconomy of writers and artists trying to get by. What happens when large numbers of skilled, creative people get tossed out of the regular economy? It's a long-standing reality in the arts. Most artists are never paid. Most paid artists only sometimes work. Which means maybe the arts offer us a kind of test case for broader changes that are now afoot. Patricia and I met often. We talked about writers we admire. We talked about their work, a lot of it unpublished. Some of the best writing is not commercial enough to ever get published. We read it when friends send a manuscript, or a stranger might make a zine or a handmade book to hand around. The work will circulate, it'll have meaning, but no money will move. We read each other, and we talk, while everyone waits for a big break, when what they call a real publisher sees the light and somebody finally makes some money from art. I've been around the block in publishing, working at every level, and a lot of the unpublished work that I see comes from very well-known writers. Even the best-known writers produce high-quality work that cannot clear the bar of commercial publishing. Their editors can't calculate an audience. The gamble on a print run cannot be made. Either the work is lost, that is, revised into commercial viability, or else it circulates in this Samistat world of manuscripts that are passed hand to hand. Patricia and I saw several superb novels that had been rejected by dozens of commercial publishers. We saw volumes of first-rate poetry that naturally had no publisher. Broke, unemployed, it seemed silly to spend our idle time lamenting this bad luck. So instead, we went out and found the machinery that was necessary for making sturdy, perfect-bound books one at a time. We contacted the writers we admired, many of them already friends, and we said, "We love your work. We want to publish it." Now, publish meant that we would make the books available, both in conventional softcover form and as e-books, available online, purchasable by anybody, anywhere. And crucially, we would talk about the work. We would attend to what I call the social life of the book, doing anything we could to help expand the circle of readers, and therefore the market for the work. We had our time, plenty of it, our taste, passion, and the sometimes puzzling or puzzled cooperation of a few talented writers. The only things that we lacked were money and any knowledge of business. The machines that made this possible are rugged, hand-operated binders, cutters, and a digital printer that's old enough to be cheap on eBay. They cost me my savings and about $500 more, but in July that year, my son and I went to New York, where the former owner of this machinery was eager to get rid of it, and we rolled it out the door and drove the whole rig back across the country to Portland. And in September 2009, Patricia Noe and I published our first book. It was a catalog for an art show. Artists Roy McMakin and Jeffrey Mitchell, two artists in Seattle who we knew and admired. Roy and Jeffrey had a show in Portland that month, and they wanted a catalog, but no one had done anything about it until about 2 weeks before the show. The pages were printed at a friend's digital shop. The covers were made from recycled manila file folders. And the title and spine were rubber stamped using a Trodat printy. It's one of those, you can actually set rubber type in these things. And that was our idea. It's like, oh, well, we could do a 1,000 books with this one. You know, little did we know exactly how tedious and meticulous you have to be to get the Trodat printy to work. We worked hard. We worked very hard. And we made 10 copies of this book just in time for the opening. And we sold all of them. So far, so good, we said to one another. Then we published a novel by Lawrence Rinder, a very funny novel. It's called Revenge of the Decorated Pigs. It's a novel about the high-stakes world of artists, collectors, and museum curators, a world Larry knows very well. He was the curator of the Whitney Museum in New York and curated the biennial there in 2002. He had amazing insights into this world, horrifying ones as well, and a very, very funny story to tell. We made one copy of his book, which you see here next to the bottle of wine that fueled that evening. And our friend Mike Merrill bought that copy. And with a profit from that sale, we made two more copies. Our friend Philip Iosca bought one, and a stranger bought the other. And so on and so on. We simply made more copies of the book and kept talking about it, because that's all we knew how to do. So those are the pages that have printed out from a digital printer. They're being clamped into a guillotine trimmer. And Patricia is now pressing the two buttons that ensure that your hands do not get sliced. And Mike Merrill, who bought this, is, we're actually making the first copy of Larry's book here for Mike, who videotaped it. The book block then gets set into this clamp, which grabs it and now drags it across into a pan of hot glue. And pulling it back up again, you've got the spine now sort of covered in dripping hot glue. The soundtrack is by somebody, I don't know who it is. And up comes the manila file folder cover, and it's pinched by these two clamps. A man named Victor Solario in Morelia, Mexico, invented this machine. And those of you who know the Espresso Book Machine will recognize that they took all their ideas from Victor. This is precisely the same machinery, which is now, I'll tell you more about that later. Having clamped, the glue dries in a matter of 7 or 8 seconds, and the machine releases the book, and this is then taken to the trimmer, trimmed off on all three sides, and the result is what you saw in the other photo. And that is what gets stamped with the Trodat on the front. Our ignorance and our poverty were our best resources. We learned these machines. We became very skilled at making books. But we literally did not know how to do a professional job of publishing. We had no understanding of our audience, no knowledge of a market, no sales strategies, no tools for carrying such things out, whatever those things might be. We only had our knowledge of how to make a book and our love of the books we were making. And we had our commitment to talk about it, to be social, to bring those gifts to others and try and make a larger public. Our poverty made the interaction matter. We could only continue if the people we talked to also came to value the work. The machines we found produce one book at a time, and that was crucial. In traditional publishing, you've got to make many books, and everything begins with a cataclysmic and very expensive moment called the launch, when a book has been produced in large numbers, is shipped to bookstores and to other points of delivery, and suddenly it is made available for the public in a market. And its life after this cataclysmic launch is a long, slow tale of pushing piles of books out to readers and making back the investment that first brought the book to life, or losing that investment. Most commercial books have a 3 or 4 month shelf life before they either succeed or they don't and are pushed off the shelves by the next wave of new releases to disappear. Our machines make sturdy, perfect bound books, we all know as a regular softcover book, one at a time by hand. So the books don't disappear, we just make another as needed. It takes about 10 or 15 minutes. It costs $4 or $5. We spend that amount each time there's a new buyer. This approach is called print on demand, POD. There are a number of different ways to do print on demand, from the online service such as Lulu, where you simply upload a file and a very normative looking paperback book will come back in the mail to you at a low price, to the Espresso Book Machine, something like our setup, but set into a bookstore context, to what we've done of trying to assemble the machinery so you can operate it by hand and do particular and peculiar things with it. With POD, you walk into our storefront and say you want a certain book, and we make it, and we hand it to you in exchange for money. It's more like a bakery or a corner cafe than it is like a traditional bookstore. The problem we now woke up to every day was, how can we make a book we love and sell it to someone? There were no other parts to this equation. There was no hidden investor. There was no long-term strategy, no warehouse, no debt, no distant goal. There was only the book that we might make and the person who might buy it. This became the way we lived. It became our occupation. Here is a lasting meaning for the Occupy movement, the occupation that is more than a temporary protest, that is one's occupation, a permanent way to live. The problem we wake up to every day. This is not a side project. It's not spare time. This was work. What relationships and conversations comprise your work? What are the things you wake up to each day as your occupation? Given our circumstances and in a way our desperation, writing, reading, and books became our occupation. That is what we wake up to each day, the task of sharing those things with others. Now, it wasn't much easier living this way than living broke. The money that came in, $1,000 the first month, a couple or a few thousand the months after, it's about $12,000 each month now, has not been life-changing. But it has always been enough for us to know this was our occupation, the work of the day, how to make someone love a book that we loved. We never shifted our problem to, say, courting an investor, making a plan, pursuing commercial strategies, whatever they might be. Books, reading, and writing became our occupation. A long-standing division in the arts puts the conduct of artistic work on one end, subjective, idiosyncratic, often very proudly misfit, and career or economic reality over on the other. And the second pole, the economic structures that move money, is driven deep into the ground like an intractable thing, rigid, unforgiving, inarguable. It's the real publisher most writers spend their time waiting for. We venerate that economy with the title of real, and artists who do not cow to it are alternately ridiculed or praised for being unrealistic, impractical, or generally indifferent to career. This is a false distinction. It fatally limits the impact of artistic imagination by making us think we cannot act as artists and transform economies. It's a lie that says art cannot directly address the movement of money within an artistic practice, and that to do so is to step outside of your work as an artist. There are two separate poles, the working artist is told, art and business. To go completely toward either one will fatally compromise your engagement with the other, or so the myth goes. This divide is old news. It's a chasm that was probably broadest in the 19th and early 20th centuries, when the aura of artistic genius became tightly bound up with a romantic idea of poverty and material want. Commerce was the great soul-destroying enemy of the artist. But in the late 20th century and in the 21st, we've seen this myth undone by artists and writers such as Marcel Duchamp, Anne Folk, Ian and Ingrid Baxter with Anything Co. out in Vancouver, many others. Their strategies are widely various, but the writers and artists involved put the economy of art production and its circulation inside of their scope as artists, as part of what they address through their own sensibility. They make business choices as art. A short list of projects like this, most of them indebted to Duchamp, turns out to be a rather long list indeed. It includes Anything Co., which was a seminal early 1960s project. Again, Ian and Ingrid Baxter, based in Vancouver, BC. It includes Artmark, the design activism group that led to the Yes Men, fairly well-known activist artist group. Klaus Oldenburg's Store, the Bruce High Quality Foundation, the Bernadette Corporation. Well, many of these businesses are carried out with a kind of knowing wink of irony that allows their practitioners to maintain that they're really artists. The more interesting ones actually risk appearing entirely ignorant of all professional standards, artistic or business. The more interesting ones operate idiosyncratically outside any measurement of good art or smart business. And among those, I would count Ann Folk, based in Seattle. Her art is conducted within the form of art administration, a professional consultancy that never bills itself as art. And yet, for now 40 years, she's conducted one of the most far-reaching practices, I believe, and is probably unknown not only to you, but to most American audiences as well, because of her success at never, pulling the curtain back, never saying this is ironic or somehow a ploy. She maintains her position sincerely. A second I would point to is Bernard Cash, a French mathematician and designer whose company Objectile creates unique pieces of furniture through mathematical equations that direct factory assembly lines to create unique pieces of furniture. In the guise of running a furniture company, Cash, who was a doctoral student under Gilles Deleuze, has done some of the most far-reaching work in philosophy and artistic formalism. So the work we know in this area tends to be better known because it's made the necessary, I would say, compromises to be legible either as good art or as smart business, whereas the most interesting work is right there in the middle, hard to read because it is not presented itself in either profession. And so these actions are typically read as strategic assaults or interventions on the business of art. And by seeing the artistic critique of business, we effectively pull apart the interesting unity that they had proposed. We end up with this metaphor of two warring camps, art and business, launching insurgencies. Artistic imperatives get pushed to one side across a gap where tactical forays are lobbed toward the other side, business, which is pathologically maintained by art lovers as the other, the great enemy. Artists like Duchamp become read as spies or double agents rather than simply being something entirely new, something that lives without this conflict, that lives in a world where these things are one. Patricia and I set up shop in a borrowed downtown storefront that was owned by sympathetic friends. They used their storefront for events, but events never started before lunch. So we ran our shop there from 6 a.m. to noon. Every day, arriving in the pre-dawn to fire up the printer, heat the glue, ready the binder, we were like neighborhood bakers. The city came to life around us. While the hot glue melted, paper stacks churned out. The smell of fresh books filled the storefront by the time the first trickle of coffee-toting drop-ins came by. Our books were very plain. We bound them in recycled file folders. And the title and author were rubber-stamped on the front. We put the date of production stamped on the spine of every copy to show you the day it was made, to reinforce the fact that here was an object which is not coming out of an inventory, out of a commercial strategy, but rather out of a single encounter one day when somebody wants a book. And with that mark on the spine, you're reminded not only of this fact, but also of the occasion on which you got the book. Because we make our books on demand, we only ever had 10 or 12 of them in the shop. They'd sit in a stack at the end of the long table where we worked. So numerous times the first few months, intrigued young 20-somethings, which Portland abounds in, would scrutinize our very few plain books, watch us earnestly working away at the wonky machinery, and ask, "Is this a performance art piece?" "No," we'd reply, "it's a business." But it was a business based on nothing except passion as readers and writers. We did business exactly the way we lived as writers. It was intense, open-ended, driven by pleasure. We published what we loved and did not consider anything else. It never mattered if only one person, or two, or 10, or 100, liked a book. We would make however many were needed. And making one book at a time, we always profited. It was an odd business, kind of like slow food, but for books. It somehow made sense to people. I think our slowness and our focus inspired people. The work emerged in the midst of some other kind of broader slowdown. Maybe we're all exhausted by shopping. The sight of a storefront empty of everything except a few plain books and two people working very hard to make more stood out, a kind of relief amidst the hectoring come-ons of retail. Our store was the opposite of retail.
You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph. This is a rebroadcast of an excellent lecture given last Wednesday, June 6th, by Matthew Stadler. He is the gentleman behind Publication Studios, a Portland-based print-on-demand publisher, and you can check out his work at publicationstudios.biz. I really recommend it. It's very fantastic. And we'll get back to that broadcast in just a moment, his lecture from last week. And if you want some more information, please do contact me. It's 837-CFRU. This is Books for Breakfast. Thanks for tuning in.
This is a shameless promo.
Hello, GC Goddess.
Oh, how was it fun for me? I'll share one story with you.
When I was young, I had a crush on Kevin Bacon.
Yes, that's one way in which you can use your sexual energy.
My boobs are a plaything. My boobs are a food source.
That sounds so disgusting, but yeah.
Fresh books filled the storefront. By the time the first trickle of coffee-toting droppings came by,
Wednesday nights at 11 p.m. on CFRU 93.3.
Our books were very plain.
Hi, we're from the 17th Grove Cub Scouts. We love Cubs because it's fun. We do crafts, play games, go on cool trips and camps, and own badges.
Cubs is great for the community because we plant trees and help the environment.
Cubs is fantastic for boys and girls because it's fun, educational, and we get to make new friends.
We're so happy CFRU invited us to tell you about Cubs because everyone should have the chance to have this experience.
We meet on Tuesday nights from 6:30 to 8:15 at Trinity United Church.
To find out more about Cub Scouts, visit the Scouts Canada website at www.scouts.ca.
As the other, the great enemy.
You hear behind me right now from the studio, Matthew Stadler, giving his lecture about Publication Studios. Last week he was in town, and let's rejoin that broadcast now.
That lives in a world where these things are one. Patricia and I set up shop in a borrowed downtown storefront that was owned by sympathetic friends. They used their storefront for events, but events never started before lunch. So we ran our shop there from 6 a.m. to noon. Every day, arriving in the pre-dawn to fire up the printer, heat the glue, ready the binder, we were like neighborhood bakers. The city came to life around us. While the hot glue melted, paper stacks churned out. The smell of fresh books filled the storefront by the time the first trickle of coffee-toting drop-ins came by. Our books were very plain. We bound them in recycled file folders. And the title and author were rubber stamped on the front. We put the date of production stamped on the spine of every copy to show you the day it was made, to reinforce the fact that here was an object which is not coming out of an inventory, out of a commercial strategy, but rather out of a single encounter one day when somebody wants a book. And with that mark on the spine, you're reminded not only of this fact, but also of the occasion on which you got the book. Because we make our books on demand, we only ever had 10 or 12 of them in the shop. They'd sit in a stack at the end of the long table where we worked. So numerous times the first few months, intrigued young 20-somethings, which Portland abounds in, would scrutinize our very few plain books, watch us earnestly working away at the wonky machinery, and ask, "Is this a performance art piece?" "No," we'd reply, "it's a business." But it was a business based on nothing except passion as readers and writers. We did business exactly the way we lived as writers. It was intense, open-ended, driven by pleasure. We published what we loved and did not consider anything else. It never mattered if only one person, or two, or 10, or 100, liked a book. We would make however many were needed. And making one book at a time, we always profited. It was an odd business, kind of like slow food, but for books. It somehow made sense to people. I think our slowness and our focus inspired people. The work emerged in the midst of some other kind of broader slowdown. Maybe we're all exhausted by shopping. The sight of a storefront empty of everything except a few plain books and two people working very hard to make more stood out, a kind of relief amidst the hectoring come-ons of retail. Our store was the opposite of retail. My son is actually in that group back there, waiting for a book. We had no stock, there's no color, no noise except the machines, no special offers, never a discount. We were friendly, very friendly, but all we ever talked about was books and the writers we loved. We had become stewards of our own passion. If someone wanted what we made, great, they'd pay us good money for it, an average of $20 a book. We valued our labor, and we valued the work of the writers who had made the books, so we always charged enough to pay everybody. Our formula is pay off costs and then split profits half-half with the writers and artists. Books are what we know. It's what we grew up with, and we know how they move and how they find readers. But we also wanted to work and reach people who don't buy books or are too far away to happen into our shop. And so from the very start, we made all of our books also as e-books. We offered them for sale online. We even post all of them for free on something we call the Free Reading Commons. On this site, anyone can read any of our books in the same page layout and format as you get on a printed book. And you can highlight and annotate with your own comments in the margins. It's kind of the digital equivalent of the marginal notes we find in our most beloved books at home, the printed books that we all scribbled in on the sides. But here, not only can you annotate, but you see the annotations of others and can respond to those too. And so conversations that move across large geographies, great differences that we might in fact never know because you see only the comments, not necessarily the person, happen online in this Free Reading Commons. A busy place, and very essential to what we call publication, this creation of new publics. The first 100 or so books that we made were mostly sold to friends. Friends loaned us the storefront. Friends came by to help, curious about the machines. Friends attended parties we'd hold for the writers, or they talked to others about our books. The freedom of what I have called middle class broke rests on this foundation of friendship and resources that are substantial, even when they add up to $0. Now, our experience so far, now with 6 publication studios in 6 different North American cities, suggests that these resources exist in all communities. But we systematically devalue them by measuring our poverty against someone else's financial wealth and not recognizing what is there. We become severed from these resources, friends, community, by the dissolving actions of markets and an endemic fear of strangers. Where politics or markets have not actively disabled them, the resources of friends, community, neighbors naturally flow toward risky ventures like ours. The poet Richard Jensen calls the business of publishing, quote, a stage dive into the waiting arms of those who love literature. Now, I will not demonstrate a stage dive right now, but you probably recognize it as the move from this height to leap off into the crowd and see what happens. This is precisely what we experienced. Our high level of risk compelled the support of an interested public. This public, which is also a market, could either catch us and we'd float magically in the sea, or part and leave us in a broken heap on the floor. I'm not sure we understood this at any conscious level, but everything conspired to make us bold, foolish, and trusting. The times, our circumstances, the giddiness of deciding to invest everything in what we loved, and we found that others responded to our risk with excitement and equal boldness. They responded by taking risks, by investing their time and attention in what we believed in.
You're listening to Campus Community Lectures on CFRU 93.3 FM. Today's lecturer is Matthew Stadler, who spoke recently in Guelph as part of the Big Ideas in Art and Culture lecture series presented by Musagetis and Kafka. Stay tuned to CFRU 93.3 FM.
What are the broader stories, what we call these times, that form the sea on which a project like this will float? They are equally the financial crisis that in fall of 2008 interrupted the smooth ascent of a global neoliberal economy. That was collapses of major banks, contractions of financial investment, contractions of government programs, multinational corporate growth, things that have thrown many, many people out of an old economy. Equally that and the proliferation of locally scaled, globally connected microeconomies, small political alliances, projects of passion, things which appear to be entirely local, but which find connection to fellow travelers near and far. They form a kind of background hum, this broader change, audible everywhere, that harmonizes with what happened to us. Broader changes, or the times, or the big picture, is a kind of myth-making that's essential for risky, imagination-based projects like publishing or political activism. Our efforts are sustained and they gain strength when we link them to bigger things, stories, movements, history. More so than money, these resources can keep a risky venture afloat, buoyant on uncertain seas while we're blown toward hopefully more friendly shores. Our work in particular has been helped by the writing of Saskia Sassen. She's a Dutch-born sociologist who first gained notoriety for the term global city, which she coined in a 1991 book of the same name. She gives that name to cities like New York, Toronto, London, Tokyo, cities that gain such a powerful confluence of global finance, they become more akin to one another and less akin to the other cities from the nations they come from. Sassen has long tracked the way that power organizes itself, and she recognizes that when the old container of the nation changes, or as she puts it, when the nation breaks open, then suddenly citizens, businesses, other elements that have been under a kind of national jurisdiction are freed up and start to form new alliances and new organizations. For example, many people are simply thrown out of the system of nations, the vast migrant population of sans-papiers, or illegal immigrants, who perform the most basic labor in developed nations around the world, often live largely outside of national laws. While at the very other end of the spectrum, wealthy corporations often mitigate the high cost of national taxes or restrictions by creating legal frameworks to let them float free of nations. So at both ends, what was once a very stable and constricting container of the nation is breaking open. The link to our tiny, uncapitalized business is surprising, but it's solid. We love literature. Our only work is to make books and find readers. And these readers, even more profoundly, the physical movement of books through the world passing from one reader to the next, only correlates incidentally to nations. Books travel across borders, and so do the passions of literature. making the books that matter to us and the dispersed collective of those who also care, we end up engaging a global audience. They find our work regardless of borders, or they find it in the deterritorialized space of the internet. We are a good example of what Sossin has recently called a multi-scalar assemblage. This concept, I think, is a key to future prosperity and future notions of justice. So I'm going to give a little detail to what a multi-scalar assemblage is. She describes it as any group of people that act at every scale, from the intimately local all the way to the global, in the course of working together. This movement across scale could be as deliberate and overwhelming as a huge company, say Coca-Cola, pursuing global distribution through networks that reach down to the tiniest local grocery store. Or they could be as short-term and tactical as survivors of a tsunami who want to get services to their villages regardless of which nations they happen to be part of. So Doctors Without Borders is a multi-scalar assemblage. The punk musicians touring Europe selling vinyl records they carry with them are a multi-scalar assemblage. The internet-savvy neighbors in a Rio favela who hook up online with activists in Buenos Aires are a multi-scalar assemblage. The Zapatistas are a multi-scalar assemblage. What is most interesting and most potent about these groups is their ability to operate with the most narrow, most local, and intimate of interests, and yet have agency on a global scale. Money is not the key. Their potency rests in their focus, this enduring intensity of their commitment. Work that means a lot locally, that means everything to the one who does it, will travel far and have relevance at a scale and pitch that cannot be equaled by globally dissolved work. Paradoxically, this narrow local focus then is the key to reaching others far away. You're legible. You can be heard and understood because you have not diluted what moves you and why you work in the interests of reaching an abstract general audience. There is no scaling up except by scaling right back down to the most immediate personal passions. We could probably understand this best if we think of our own memories of traveling. What registers clearly, what we remember, the further we go from home, are not the calculated accommodation of, say, McDonald's tweaking burgers and salads to address a French or African cuisine. What registers and leaves an enduring mark is this hyper-local production, a Frenchman or an African making something they know well and love for a local clientele that understands it. That's food we remember. It echoes our own passions and leaves a mark. In the political realm, what can beckon solidarity of, say, a water rights group in Brazil won't be the acknowledgement of a large organization like UNESCO, especially now that these top-down AIDS groups are more starved of resources and less able to reach local causes. What will matter more in Sossin's analysis of multi-scalar assemblages is to find the sympathetic groups who are near or far that share the same needs, to form horizontal links to these groups, and by moving across scale, register globally, find resources and fellow travelers, and yet stay focused on the immediately local. What all these groups have in common is a paradoxical marriage of low-tech, labor-intensive tools, the favela's hoses and barrels to carry water, the punk musicians' cassette tapes or vinyl, the Zapatistas' handmade fake wooden rifles, the symbols that their army carried to announce the militancy of their cause, combined with a savvy use of digital and internet tools to make themselves legible, to connect across scale.
You're listening to Matthew Stadler. That was his lecture last week in Guelph, sponsored by Music Eddies and Kafka. There's about 20 minutes left in that lecture, and he goes on to further explain his work with Publication Studios out of Portland, Oregon. He and fellow writer Patricia Ngo and designer Antonio Pinter run this beautiful borrowed little studio whereby they can print on demand the work of the books that they love and create social life for the literature that they make. So the three major tenets of Publication Studio are this print-on-demand technology. They've basically invested a couple thousand dollars of machine into machinery that creates books. Then, as I say, the social life of these books, they create parties and launches and get-togethers to then fet these books and make sure that people talk about them. And then finally, the digital commons. Each of the books that the Publication Studio prints is also available for free online as an ebook. And in a space where you can annotate these books. So you can go there and read them yourself and leave your comments and see the comments of other readers, thereby further extending the social life of this book. Matthew Stadler is a pretty amazing guy. It was very inspiring to have him in town last week. And last week on Books for Breakfast, so that's the show from the 7th, we did a small interview with him in studio. So you can also catch that at CFRU Archives. That's cfru.ca. That's about time for the show this week. I really hope that something comes out of this visit from Matthew Stadler. It's possible that we could have a Publication Studio Guelph, where we could, as he says in the early parts of this lecture, print artists' catalogs or, closet poetry or anthologies of book reviews from kids. You know, if you can print one book at a time and basically work a literary culture face-to-face, then... it seems that the possibilities are endless. Thanks for tuning in to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph. I'm your host, Dan Evans, on Books for Breakfast. That's about it for another week. Next week, we're most likely going to have a local bookbinder, Louisa Kratka, who's taken over as kind of the local bookbinder. So she runs LM Bookbindery. I'm hoping she'll come on. It's all but confirmed. If not, she'll be on in the coming weeks. You can always check out our blog, booksradio.com. I'm signing off. Thanks for listening to Books for Breakfast.
Hey, my name's Andrew. I volunteer and have a show here at CFRU. Hopefully you can too.